Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
A few years ago, when COVID restrictions were hampering retail trade everywhere, the owner of the George's Street Arcade in Dublin, Gwen Layden, allowed her tenants to hold off on paying their rent. When universal restrictions ended, stallholders could pay in phases while their bruised businesses picked up. And when, a couple of years later, the first Ukrainians arrived in Ireland as refugees from war at home, Gwen Layden offered to help again by covering the rent, insurance and start-up costs of a stall in the market. As a student in the late 80s and 90s, I was a regular in the arcade. We all were, kicking about in our giant boots, waiting for someone to introduce us to self-esteem and the mobile phone. It was free to covet the vintage silk taffetas and ropes of beads in Jenny Vander, to open and click-close the handbags of hardened leather. Mark's Brothers sandwiches were not free, but they were accessibly cheap. They came with mugs of boiled coffee and the right to linger in the basement, wallpapered in hand-lettered gig posters. The spirit of Mark's Brothers lived on until last year in another cafe, Simon's Place. But to thrive, arcade life develops and moves on, and today's newer stalls and shops are as many and various as ever. A juice bar, a psychic, a body piercer. Rare, the K-pop shop one of my nieces introduced me to. Megan Maguire's Seeking Judy knitwear and bags, as seen in the pages of Vogue. The ornate red brick market is vast, built as the South City Market in 1881 to occupy an entire block bounded by George's Street, Exchequer Street, Drury Street and Fade Street. In the 1880s, the central market hall was home to about 25 stalls, confectioners, greengrocers, butchers, shellfishmongers. Large shops, cafes, dressmakers, hotels and restaurants occupied the perimeter and opened into the surrounding streets. But while the South City Market was still a relatively new feature of the city, the arcade was all but destroyed. In the early hours of the 27th of August, 1892, a fire broke out in the market hall and whipped up towards Drury Street, pulling stall after stall into its blaze. It tore through shops until tongues of fire burst through rooftops and windows. People stumbled from bed and ran into the air in their nightclothes. Others were roused and rescued by strangers. A dazed, terrified crowd watched as the men of the Dublin Fire Brigade, directed by Thomas Purcell, tried to bring the fire under control. They stopped it from igniting the thousands of barrels of whiskey in the Powers bonded warehouse, but the stalls were lost and many of the other businesses were gutted. Astonishingly, there was not a single death. That hot August week was horse show week, and with an eye to the country customers flooding into the city, Elizabeth Kenny had bought in extra stock for her fruit stall. In fact, she said, her stock was the largest I had this season, and I generally had a very large one. None of the beautiful fruit she had sourced to tempt the horse show visitors survived. Her prize grapes, Spanish melons, pineapples and luscious peaches were gone, along with the humbler potatoes and peas. Also gone for good were the fixtures and equipment essential to her business. Shelves and countertop, scales and measures, bags and baskets. Even her account books, ledgers and files were burned. She knew that her credit customers owed her about £200, but the proof of that was in ashes. There were some huge losses that night. £20,000 worth of stock and damage in the case of Pym's furniture warehouse, but at least they were insured. Others lost less in financial terms, but if it was everything you owned, the loss was far greater. Lucy Conlon had been living and working in Warren's Hotel on the corner of George's Street and Exchequer Street. A couple of days after the fire, she wrote, "I was one of the servant girls in Warren's Hotel. I escaped in my nightdress. My box with all I had was consumed, which leaves me destitute and without means to purchase clothes to procure a situation." Anna Mangan, a florist with premises at 29 Drury Street, told a similar story. She and her four children escaped in their nightclothes, and nothing was saved. "I am utterly ruined," she wrote, "without even a bed to lie on, the clothes that are covering us being borrowed." How were people to recover? The Lord Mayor of Dublin quickly established a relief fund, and chunky contributions materialised from well-known commercial names like Arnott's, Powers, Jemison, Guinness and Jacobs. Plenty of smaller businesses and compassionate fellow citizens contributed too, and a committee assessed applications for assistance. Elizabeth Kenny was given £60 to cover the costs of setting up another fruit stall from scratch. Lucy Conlon was granted £3 to buy clothes so that she could apply for another job. Anna Mangan and her family were given £135 to cover their domestic and commercial losses. Between 60 and 70 of the market community were helped. Over £1,000 was distributed. The market was rebuilt and reopened just 2 years after the fire and has operated ever since as home to a dynamic population of independent traders. The skill and bravery of those who fought the fire and the generosity of those who donated to the relief fund enabled Dubliners to spin a good news story from a disaster. Well over a century on, those rent reductions during COVID and stall space for wartime refugees suggests that the Georgia Street Arcade Market is still a community, still somewhere to find good news amid bad.
No, I don't believe I'm an angel. Troubles pushed me to fall, nor that you could have saved me from God or anything.
I've seen so much rain in my time, but the time I recall most clearly is when I was at sea as a young officer. I was a newly promoted second officer, and I was on a Merchant Navy cargo passenger vessel in the South Atlantic, coming from New Orleans, bound for Auckland. It had rained for days, downpours with no let-up. Vicious freezing rain, so unlike the monsoon rains that bucket down, but at least they're warm. But down in the South Atlantic, with no other ship around and no sign of land for miles, it rained hard and bitterly cold for days. When the first officer was handing over watch to me, "Keep an eye on the glass," he said. "It's falling. We're heading into something nasty. We should reduce speed until the glass starts to rise." I'll talk to the old man, meaning the captain, and I thought he'll ignore that advice. Then came the wind. Before my watch had finished, ragged clouds started to race across the darkening sky, developing into Gale 8, then Storm 10, then Severe Storm 12. Our engine was a Doxford type with 8 units or cylinders, and they were being closed down by the engineers, one after another, due to scavenge fires caused, we later discovered, by excessive sulphur content in an inferior fuel oil taken on at our last port of call. Eventually, there were only 2 units working and the storm was getting worse. A bleak time ahead with the engineers working flat out to keep the 2 remaining units working with, as I have said, no other ships around. But what made it bleaker was the captain. He started to panic. He was always a nervous and unsure man who'd drop anchor 2 or 3 times before he was satisfied, whenever we had to drop anchor. But sitting with the passengers at mealtimes, he was in his element. He was nice enough on a fine day, but wasn't cut out for bad news or bad times or pressure. Already we had lost all deck cargo, 6 John Deeres, 4 excavators and numerous drums of oil, all washed overboard, and the storm showed no sign of letting up. The captain was wandering around the ship, telling whoever would listen to him with a shrill voice, that we were finished and done for, as he put it. You can imagine what effect this had on the crew. Even at best of times, one of them was always liable to cut loose, as they always felt they were being kept in the dark about good or bad news. Now fear percolated down to the cabin boy. As the storm raged on and the captain staggered about with his tale of woe, the first officer came to me. This was a very quiet man, taciturn even, a man who never made a fuss, didn't care which way his eggs were boiled, hard or soft. That about sums him up, but in every way sound and reliable. He stood beside me and, as if he was just passing the time of day, remarked, "We'll lock him up. Do you agree?" I agreed. I was with him. We approached the captain. "You'd better come along with us," was all that the first officer said, and we led the way, with difficulty in the heaving storm, to the ship's hospital. The captain followed us without a word. He seemed, if anything, relieved as the three of us stumbled along the corridor to the hospital cabin. We opened the door. He walked inside and made no comments or protest as we turned the key. The first officer didn't say anything about assuming command. He just turned around to face the storm again, and eventually, with great difficulty and skill, he was able to bring the ship's head about into the wind, which showed how strong it was, as we were now doing 3 or 4 knots astern or backward. The storm raged on for another 9 hours, and when it finally veered off and petered out, we were drained, but we felt safe again. The old moon came out slicing through the sooty clouds and shone down and seemed to say, "Don't blame me, you are safe now." We released the captain, who promptly returned to the bridge. He never said a word about what we'd done, and we never made an entry in the ship's log regarding the incident. Did the captain mention it in the captain's log? I'll never know. I was to meet that first officer once again some years later down in Lourenço Marques in Mozambique. We sat in the sunshine at a table and had a quiet beer together, but, true to character, he never mentioned anything about our quiet mutiny. It was as if it had never happened. A quiet mutiny by a quiet man in a loud and raging sea. After a time, we said goodbye and went our separate ways, but leaving him that sunny afternoon in sunny Mozambique, I thought surely it burned in his memory as it did mine, that strange encounter between the captain, the first mate and me, down in the rain in the South Atlantic Sea.
I lost my hip in San Martino. It wasn't the one I was born with, of course, those hips are long gone. At 26 years of age, they gave me 2 new ones in spanking titanium steel, a joy to behold, a miracle of modern engineering. When I looked at the X-rays afterwards, I saw 2 curved shafts orbited by wires that looked like the tracks of electrons in those representations of atoms we studied at school. I was proud of them. They cost me a lot in sleepless nights and pain. But I remember the surgeon saying to me, "You'll never have pain in your hips again." And he was right. Even when, 42 years later, one of them failed, I had no pain. My daughter-in-law, a physiotherapist, told me that there was so much scar tissue around the broken joint that it held me upright. But I was convinced I had pulled a muscle badly and needed to walk more. So I spent a week walking around Italy, going out with friends, going to a concert, a book launch, taking the evening passeggiata, all on a broken hip. In the end, the penny dropped. I was taken by ambulance to the Ospedale Policlinico San Martino, one of the biggest and best hospitals in Europe, the main public hospital for the city of Genoa and the Liguria region. When the doctor in the emergency department saw the x-ray, she said, "I've never seen this model of hip before. Do you know anything about it?" As it happens, my son had once been a curator in the Science Museum in London, and they had one there, and I could ask him. He texted me back a few minutes later with the technical data. The doctor took one look at it and burst out laughing. "I've read about it in the history books," she said, "but I never thought I'd actually see one." This was the pattern of my encounters at San Martino. The primario, the consultant, as we would say, told me they would need to research the hips and buy in special instruments for the operation, and it would take time. All the members of his team were excited at the thought of operating on a piece of archaeology, a historical artefact. I suspect they were all thinking of writing a paper for a learned journal. I could imagine the title, Medical Archaeology, Excavating a 42-Year-Old Hip. Even the nurses and the physio wanted to know all about it. I was a curiosity, even in a hospital well used to foreigners and their skiing accidents and car accidents and cycling accidents. I should say that I was in a ward specialising in complex traumatic orthopaedic surgery. In a hospital that large, the specializations are very specialized. How was my stay in San Martino? Confined to the bed for a week before the operation, I slowly got to know the ways of an Italian hospital. For example, I learned that mealtimes coincided with visiting times, a completely natural coincidence for Italy, because who would want to eat alone when they could eat with family and friends? The food, though, was especially terrible, a shocking fact in a land where food is life. It all came in sealed plastic containers, fresh from the hospital-sized microwave, and it was all equally inedible. How did I find being in hospital in a part of Italy where almost nobody speaks English? Fine. Firstly, because everybody was very kind and praised me for, as they often said, speaking Italian better than themselves. A typical piece of Italian courtesy extended to beginner and expert alike. And secondly, because all medical and scientific terminology is more or less derived from Latin anyway, more or less the same in English and Italian, with the addition or subtraction of a vowel here and there. There were a few major cultural differences. For example, the nurses were shocked that I liked to sleep with my feet outside the blankets. I had to make an argument for it every night. Eventually, one nurse rationalised it. She had been working there for almost 30 years, she told me, and in that time, she had noticed that la gente del nord, the people of the north, all slept with their feet out. It was strange, but obviously an ancient tradition in that part of the world. And how did the operation go? Well, I was asleep, so I can't say for sure, but for me it was easy. The primario said it took longer than they expected, but they were happy with it. And the recovery has been easy. As I write, I now have a 3-month-old hip and a 42-year-old hip. The old one is fine for now, they say. The original surgeon told me he hoped it would last 20 or even 25 years. So why did it last so long? According to my son, it was made of Soviet titanium. They made things last back in those days. Gorbachev was General Secretary of the Communist Party, and he had an interest in steel, as an Italian engineer who knew him once told me. Unfortunately, it has outlasted both Gorbachev and the Soviet Union itself. I liked old Gorby. I don't think Putin is making hips like that, whatever else he's at.
It's not easy to photograph the shark-like fish known as the flapper skate. At 3 metres wide, wingtip to wingtip, it's a challenge to fit one inside the shot, especially when you're on a small boat, legs backed against wet fiberglass, abandoning your upper body to the air. When leaning any further back, will likely topple you into the Irish Sea. But we're jumping ahead. To photograph a flapper skate, first you need to catch one. It was mid-June and the sea was unusually still. A flat calm, or in technical terms, a sea state zero. The boat was the Wee Gem, and in it my companions Ronald and Ian were cramming tackle boxes next to oilskins and lunch bags. I wobbled on board and felt, I can't help but say it, out of my depth. I was the marine biologist for this trip and supposedly the expert among us, but I hadn't even been on a boat for 5 years. Ronald and Ian were the anglers, the ones who spent every possible minute on the water, the ones who knew where to find the skate. We headed northeast towards the Maidens, a collection of islets off the Antrim coast and a good place, Ronald said, to catch bait. On the way, I showed him the first skate images returned from sea long before photography. In a 16th century hoax, skate bodies were deliberately deformed, dried, and brought ashore by sailors claiming they had found angels, demons, or monsters. The true story of the flapper skate is less magical. It's a story of overfishing, population collapse, and desperate conservation attempts. I clutched my camera and watched the swell rise. We were hunting the largest skate in the world, in one of the last places they were believed to survive. A photograph could help to confirm that, providing evidence that they were not yet lost from this coast. The image I was after had paperwork behind it, declarations to the government about the experience of each person on board, certificates of training in handling techniques. There are so few flapper skate left that you must hold a license even to photograph one. The day passed gently. Seals rose around us, watched us for a while, and slipped away. The boat rocked on low waves, and occasionally we moved position. By early evening, we were at our third skate mark, the name given to fishing sites where skate are often found. The other marks, it seemed, had been empty. Ian threw back an undersized mackerel, and we decided to go home. That is when we noticed the skate rod bending absurdly towards the water. Ian grabbed the harness. An adult flapper skate can weigh over 100 kilograms, about the same as a baby elephant. Its jaws are designed to crush shell and can remove a finger just as easily. While Ronald secured Ian to the boat, he explained to me that landing the skate could take a full 20 minutes. It seemed longer. I watched the grey waves and the quivering rod. I watched Ian's face, intent and strained. I waited for the line to break and the monster, the angel, to dissolve into the dark sea. Then a glimmer underwater, something pale metres from the surface rising towards us. The skate seemed composed, stately even, and for a moment I regretted our intent to extract her, though only briefly, in the name of scientific endeavour. And yet, if the skate population had been healthier, we would not have been there. The species is classed as critically endangered. The next stage is extinct in the wild. Time was tight. It took both men to carry the skate on deck, and the second she was there, I got to work, measuring, scribbling down frantic numbers. I grabbed my camera and began backing towards the side of the boat. She didn't fit in the viewfinder, so I edged back again until I was as far as I could go, then I leaned back some more over the gunwale. The skate lay calmly on the deck, her long nose towards the camera, her eyes dark and still. A few clicks, another with Ian sitting by her tail. Then arms were under her, slowly lifting, and she was lowered back into the sea. The skate floated at the surface briefly, then with a flick and a flash of white, she was gone. The boat turned towards the coast and I scanned through the image thumbnails. Me, one hand placed on her wing, the other holding a tape measure. Ian crouching by her tail, grinning madly. The skate, alone on the deck, the end of each wing just inside the frame. Photographs for campaigning, photographs as trophies. But most importantly, photographs as data, as evidence of an all but mythic creature, which, thanks to the efforts of local anglers, may now not be lost.
There's a cock step coming into the evenings. An optimist by nature, my grandmother liked making this pronouncement each year. She was referring to the extra light in the sky as we move from winter solstice towards spring brightness. She could feel that stirring in the air, something very faint and very subtle but nonetheless tangible. She knew the clockwork belly of the earth was shifting, gathering its breath, somewhat like the movement of a timepiece as it prepares to strike the hour. The creep is gradual, but she was attuned to it. When I think about her now, she might rightly be described as a wise woman. Minimally educated, yet she observed the world about her with great curiosity, marvelled at its complexity, and thus came to a heightened understanding of nature. Anyone who has observed the arrogant strut of a cockerel in a hen run will know the length of a cock step and easily equate it to the glide of evening light as measured by my grandmother. She read the weather by assaying the smoke from her chimney. High pressure signalled by straight emissions and low pressure when the same smoke fell to the ground. Rain on the way if there were caps of cloud on distant Slieve na Mon, and thus no point in hanging sheets on the line. She was also an observer of the moon and its cycles. I marvelled how she would suggest seed sowing in conjunction with its phases. This is a time of year when I like to sit and contemplate seed catalogues with a view to a new season of vegetable growing. Having experienced poor cropping and indeed complete failures in recent times, I believe I should try my grandmother's belief in seed sowing under the influence of a full moon. Proponents of my grandmother's theory suggest that just as the moon's gravitational pull influences the tides, it also has an effect on soil moisture, pulling it towards the surface. Some seeds perform better when they're exposed to light, so planting during the full moon could perhaps enhance the process. Certain phases of the moon are considered conducive to planting. Moon-based planting guides suggest sowing seeds for crops that yield an above-ground harvest when the moon is waxing. Root crops, on the other hand, are best sown during a waning moon. My grandmother studied the calendar of the moon and its cycles in the pages of Old Moore's Almanac. Throughout the seasons, she made sure the book was close to hand, and I recall how dog-eared and tea-stained it became as the months progressed. She bought a fresh copy each year from a street trader in our town. Moll Daly liked to perch on the window ledge of the post office in the main street and sold, amongst other things, issues of the green-covered almanac. It was not unusual for peddlers to sell copies of the book. Back then, many considered that it brought good luck to the purchaser. The almanac was devised and published by a teacher of classics and mathematics called Theophilus Moore in Dublin in 1764. It gave details of tides and moons and was considered invaluable to both farmers and fishermen. It also made predictions of important and disastrous happenings. For example, it might foretell of wars, the death of popes, calamitous weather events, horoscopes, and remarkable as it might sound, some of these prophecies came to pass. The almanac is on sale right up to present times. Moll and my grandmother had a few things in common. Both were considered accurate soothsayers. And in the way my grandmother might augur rain, Moll was also gifted with a form of prophecy. Her husband, known as the Ducker, had developed a sideline amusement during fair days. He would crouch inside a wooden barrel. Moll sold to willing spectators rubber balls which they would throw at the Ducker whenever he popped his head out of the barrel. The Ducker was a survivor of the Great War, and a rubber ball represented little danger in comparison to bombardment in the trenches. Still, many suspected that his escapes occurred as a result of a prearranged series of Moll's coughs. These may have helped the above barrel appearances be less damaging to his health. My almanac predicts a so-called warm moon. It is known as such because warming soil temperature entices earthworms to become active. The wolf moon of January and the snow moon of February might be a little too early for my seed sowing, and perhaps the pink moon of April too late for purpose. But occurring as it does many cock steps into the year, the full warm moon of March might be a signal to get dirt under my fingernails for yet another growing season.
I was privileged to know and work with the pioneering psychiatrist Ivor Brown for a while. When he was dying, I had a vivid dream and I wrote this poem to try and express my love and gratitude for all that he taught us and all that he gave. Dearest teacher, as your body was dying, I flew to your side, told you that everything you taught me was passed on to others, a thousandfold returning. Such music. Such light. The next morning, I listened to Schubert, the string quartet, number 14. You put that record on for us one evening in your house. Listen, you said, can you hear the foreboding, the terror, the softer notes coming in, the comfort of death? The piece ends with the tarantella, the traditional dance to ward off madness and death, a dance you knew well. Sitting with you in meditation. Please start, you'd say. I'd close my eyes, look within at the speed of thought, images slowing until even those would fade. That's all, you'd whisper, call me back to the world. Working with you in the old church in Grange Gorman, sometimes we danced. Mostly people lay down on mattresses, unearthing the past. Breathing into the dark. You moved from one to the other, holding this one as she cried, holding the anger of another. As each session ended, you'd join Jacques in the music room. Then we'd hear the Novus Magnificat, notes falling like snow. Who, me, you'd say when we thanked or praised you. I'm just an old donkey. And in a way you were. Our weight on your back. And that morning, after staying over, you brought me a glass of fresh orange juice. On my way downstairs to have breakfast with June, I turned to see you making my bed. That humility, that tenderness, is the sound of you playing a slow air on the whistle in the next room, your breath.
On this morning's programme, we heard Fire at the South City Market by Antonia Hart, A Very Quiet Mutiny by Eddie Vallely, I Lost My Hip in San Martino was by William Wall, Capturing the Flapper Skate by Rebecca Hunter, The Cock Step of Light was by Joe Carney, and Dearest Teacher for Ivor Brown, a poem by Lanny O'Hanlon. The music was Don't Let Me Stand on My Own by Imelda May with Niall McNamee, Drunken Sailor by Martin Hayes and Brooklyn Ryder, La Vergine degli Angeli by Verdi, performed by Leontine Price with the John Aldiss Choir and the London Symphony Orchestra, Carnival of the Animals, Aquarium by Saint-Saëns, performed by Lang Lang, and lastly, Moonlight Serenade by Glenn Miller. And William Wall's latest novel, Writers Anonymous, will be out soon. It's published by New Island Books. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back on the RTE radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.